You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Chris Molina. Coming up as the 2018 FIFA World Cup kicks off, we'll get a refresher on soccer from the author of a new book about the sport and its role in global culture.
First, a federal judge's ruling this week in favor of telecom and media companies AT&T and Time Warner means that their proposed $85.4 billion merger will move forward.
Lawyers from the Department of Justice, which brought the suit against the companies, argued that this deal would violate antitrust laws and harm consumers and competitors. However, a federal judge disagreed, saying the government didn't prove that a marriage of the companies would result in an increased advantage over competitors.
Christopher Sagers is the James A. Thomas Distinguished Professor of Law at Cleveland State University. He's here with us to walk through the ruling and what it means for consumers and the future of antitrust law. Chris, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Well, assuming there isn't some kind of last-minute stay or appeal that blocks this thing, and that seems unlikely at this point, what happens next?
Yeah, so they're probably going to consummate the merger, meaning that they're going to take whatever steps are necessary to close it and to integrate their operations. And I think they'll probably do that pretty quickly. There's sort of certain strategic reasons to do that, and also, firms that have held deals like this up in limbo have a lot of strong reasons to get them closed fast. It's a lot of pressure, a lot of uncertainty for them. So it'll go quickly.
Is this something that once it's done, a done deal, is this something that consumers are going to start noticing different deals or packages or services available?
Yeah, that's a real good question. Presumably, you'll notice at least some superficial, some apparent changes in quality, some changes in the package of services being offered to you. A big and interesting question is whether you're going to see a price increase. One thing that may happen and will be ironic from my point of view, I wouldn't be surprised if there actually aren't really significant price increases in the near term. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of people will take that as evidence that the government was off base or this wasn't a good lawsuit or whatever. I'd go into some more detail about that if you like, but I think that would be really, really missing the point. I think that we were on the verge, potentially, of a really pretty significant change in in-home video delivery that could have been really good for you and me, the average consumer, after truly decades of seriously competitively compromised markets in video. I mean, I don't think anybody's ever been very happy with the cable company or believed that the cable company was giving them a very good deal over the last some decades. And I think that the biggest disappointment here is that we might have been on the verge of finally seeing all that change for the better, and this deal is probably one part of what will keep that from happening.
Why is that?
Well, so the biggest, most exciting thing in the past few years has been the rise of streaming video, and I think everybody ought to be surprised by how well Netflix and Amazon Prime have done in making that happen. I fear, though, that for streaming video to really, change things significantly, so that we could all sort of cut the cord and do so with significant cost savings, without giving up quality, that really did kind of depend on the streaming entities being able to get all the content they could at competitive prices. And I think that the purpose of this rash of vertical integration in media that is now starting and probably will continue, I think is mainly to keep control over that content so that, the golden cow that once was coaxial cable doesn't get killed off by sort of flourishing new competition.
Talking to Chris Sagers from Cleveland State University, looking at the approval of this merger between AT&T and Time Warner, what it's going to mean for the future. Chris, it seems like a lot of times, I'm no expert on judge rulings on antitrust lawsuits, but a lot of times the legal opinion from the judge is going to be on this hand, on the other hand. It seems like this judge was pretty excited to rule this way. Lots of exclamation points, kind of dunking on the government in this thing, right?
Yeah. And, as you may know, there's been some talk about the fact that this particular judge is a bit of a character. The exclamation points are sort of a personal trademark. I suppose reasonable minds could differ just how much his sort of personality, his maverick nature, his politics, or whatever, were really at stake. But to say the least, the opinion was pretty surprising, and I think it's fair to say that this judge felt very strongly in the defendant's favor.
So what was the argument from the government? This is not the kind of action we always see from the federal government, an antitrust challenge to something. It's not a merger between two companies that do the same thing. Like, it's not Ford right. and General Motors. That's clearly going to reduce competition in the auto market.
Right.
This is Vertical, they call it, the company that owns the internet tubes, or part of them,
right.
AT&T, and then a content provider, Time Warner. Why did the government pursue this?
Yeah. So a lot of reasons, really. I mean, I think we all remember still, there was a fair bit of controversy surrounding why the government brought the case. And there was speculation that it may have had something to do with President Trump's own personal politics. I never personally believed that. It feels a bit like water under the bridge at this point. I don't think Judge Leon believed it, or at least he didn't believe it enough. That he permitted the defendants to try to talk about it in court. He basically kept all that out. So I think there's a different reason they brought it. I think the government genuinely believed that there is significant consumer harm at stake here in this one particular deal, and probably also in the shuffling of the chairs that seems to be coming very imminently in Hollywood in response to it. And I agree with them. In terms of the sort of economic, you know, theoretical substance, the argument's pretty simple. Like, it comes off as very complicated. Judge Leon described it as complicated. And if you read the expert report, surely it would be very difficult to read. But in principle, the arguments are pretty simple. Even though it's not a horizontal deal, as you say, it's not Ford and GM. It's more like Ford acquiring a car dealer lot or something like that. Even so, we've always believed in economics. And there's always been a consensus among antitrust folks that vertical integration probably can achieve some pretty good things, but it also, in appropriate cases, poses some risk of harm. And the simplest theory is, let's say I'm AT&T. I'm a distributor, essentially, of cable television or television services, and I acquire a content producer. For example, in this case, AT&T acquired HBO, one of the assets owned by the target company. HBO produces some very popular shows. So maybe the very simple theory of harm here would be AT&T, now it owns HBO, it will say to its competing cable systems and other video distributors like Amazon and Netflix, if you want to have Game of Thrones, you got to pay us a whole lot of money. Okay, so this is the so-called foreclosure theory. So AT&T is going to raise the price of these content assets to the other distributors that might want to have access to those assets as a way of hurting its own competitors horizontally. Okay, so that's the foreclosure theory. We've always believed that's at least possible. That kind of theory came to be under a lot of academic criticism over the past three or four decades, and that is why, as everybody heard in all the press coverage of this case, vertical mergers are rarely challenged. It got to be the case that people just were finding it very hard to see how vertical integration really could be used to hurt competition in that way, except in extraordinary cases, because, you know, if you own HBO, It might make sense that you could hurt your horizontal distributor competitor by keeping them from having Game of Thrones. But on the other hand, you're losing a bunch of revenue because you're not selling Game of Thrones anymore. So the argument, particularly by sort of conservative lawyers and economists for a long time, has been that vertical theories of foreclosure are just very implausible. Well, in this case, the government put on some theories of harm that were essentially quite elaborate elaborations of that foreclosure theory. It was an attempt to sort of update foreclosure and related theories of vertical harm sort of for the 21st century with some more complicated theory. This was the test case, right? These new theories had really never been tried out in litigation before. Nobody knew if it was going to work. And we do now know.
We're exploring the ins and outs of a U.S. District Court ruling on the merger of AT&T and Time Warner. They got the go-ahead. Chris Sagers is with us, law professor at Cleveland State University.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about this merger? Are you worried it'll result in higher prices for the consumer? Or do you think this will mean better, more unique content in the long run? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. You can also tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR.
We're finding out what's ahead for consumers after a federal judge ruled this week that the merger between AT&T and Time Warner could go ahead. Our guest is Chris Sagers, law professor at Cleveland State University.
And we want you to join in by calling us at 800-642-1234. Do you hope the government appeals this judge's ruling? What do you think this will mean for competitors in these industries? And how do you think this is going to affect you as a consumer? Give us a call right now. That number again is 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR on Twitter.
Chris, you mentioned just a few moments ago that this was a test case. And all right, this is AT&T and Time Warner. We could see things like drugstore companies merging with insurance companies. This could open the door to a lot of similar mergers in other industries, right?
Right, absolutely. Absolutely. And as I think you probably know, there's a couple of big ones in healthcare pending right now. As you say, two insurance companies happen to be trying to buy, you know, pharmaceutical distributors just right now. Cigna and Aetna are both in such deals. Comcast, which is one of the biggest video companies in the world, is right now trying to buy Fox. And I think we'll probably see other attempts like this. And yeah, it's a pretty good question. A pretty good question, which I think has a pretty easy answer. Will the government try this again? There is still some conceivable likelihood that the government will appeal and will win on appeal, but it's a very uphill battle. And so I think that probably we can say with some confidence that vertical merger enforcement is dead. And not only that, vertical mergers probably just got even more legal than they were before. In the following sense, for the past few decades, the federal agencies have at least been able to get some concessions in these deals sometimes. And in particular, they were able to get the so-called conduct concessions, like agreements that the firms wouldn't discriminate against their rivals for 7 years or whatever. But after this ruling, I wouldn't imagine that any party will ever accept those again. Because now the government, you know, if the government comes with some set of concessions, and assuming they're anything more than window dressing, the parties will just say, fine, take us to court. It's obvious you would lose.
Let's go to our callers now. John is on the line in Windsor. John, hi.
Hi. So I'm having a difficult time understanding this. Okay, AT&T, who owns DirecTV, just bought Time Warner, who also is in business with Charter under the Spectrum brand. Okay, now all of a sudden you have these four different cable companies all working together, okay? So I don't see how this is not really looking at like some kind of a massive organization.
John, thanks. Is there a horizontal element to this, Chris?
Yeah, there's not. That's actually a common misconception. Time Warner indeed did once have a significant cable company, Time Warner Cable, but that was spun off some years ago. So the assets that are being purchased here don't involve a cable company. They don't involve any meaningful distribution assets.
John, thanks for the call and for bringing that up. We'll go now to Gail in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
I have a couple of things, but one is that the libertarians are taking over the Republican Party and nobody seems to be aware, because a lot of these conglomerates taking place, these big purchases, are all part of that, shifting our democracy into something that isn't going to look like our democracy in the near future. But with this AT&T taking over, do you think that more jobs are going to be going out of the country in, and whether or not functions will be merged, and again, we'll find people on the beach and synergize out of jobs.
Gail, thanks for the call. Now, in that the horizontal merger, two car companies or whatever, you would often expect to see job losses as they merge functions. Is this something that's likely in this kind of more vertical merger, Chris?
Yeah, that's a real good question. I think that job losses immediately following from this merger are not going to be like economy-wide significance. I mean, there definitely will be sort of synergizing. Cost cutting, so people will lose jobs. That in and of itself, I don't really see this particular merger having macroeconomic consequences.
Thanks for that call, Gail. We'll go next to James in the Fond du Lac area. James, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, James?
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I worked for a small utility at one time, and through the years, we've been gobbled up. That's what we say. And we were like a small family, but things change. And the whole structure and everything, it took away the cohesiveness that we had as employees. And, you know, from the other part, the companies are just getting too big. That's my perspective.
James, thanks a lot for the call. And Gail kind of touched on that, too. Chris, apart from the competitive side of things, is it a problem in our economy, in our democracy, as Gail was saying, if companies are just too darn big?
Yeah, I totally think so. And I think, too, that, you know, when I talk antitrust, I mostly talk about just the competition issues. I mean, that's what the law is mostly about now. But there definitely are these larger, arguably more important atmospheric issues that surround the competitiveness of individual markets. And, I mean, what occurred to me as the last caller was speaking was, you know, everyone who's worked in a larger firm has had that experience. The corporate consolidation is an awful thing to live through and so often doesn't live up to its promises. And, indeed, the evidence is pretty significant. Empirical evidence performed by economists over the past few decades that these mergers really may not be doing all that much good, and that in the sense that even shareholders of the companies, even in big horizontal deals, aren't actually enjoying very much in the way of better stock performance following the big mergers. And it begs, why companies keep doing this? If it's not even making money for the shareholders, why do it? And I think it has a lot to do with the influence and the worldview of the sort of corporate managerial culture that runs these firms. I'm not at all convinced that AT&T Time Warner is going to do all that much good even for the firm's shareholders, but it's going to do a whole lot of good for the top executives of the firms and their bankers. And so folks like the last caller perhaps pay quite a lot of consequences for these deals, and it's not clear that anybody else is really getting much good out of it.
James, thanks for that call. We're talking to Chris Sagers from Cleveland State University about the AT&T Time Warner merger. Got the go-ahead from a judge this week. Chris, I don't want to get out of this without bringing up the A word. A lot of companies like these two are worried about Amazon coming into their sector and blowing them out of the water, and they think, we got to get big to survive. Is there an argument for companies doing that?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, they always say it. And maybe for example, some competitors of Amazon in some of its sectors may feel like they have to get big to compete. And above all, suppliers of products to Amazon feel like they need bargaining leverage. They need to get bigger so that Amazon can't force down the wholesale prices. And I can surely feel their pain, but it's a terrible situation if it really comes to pass that the only way to deal with problems like this in the economy is to have not only one monopoly, but a bunch of other monopolies doing business with it. Because when two monopolies, like a supplier of something to Amazon and Amazon, when you got two monopolies arguing with each other, it allows them both to protect their own interests, but they sure as heck aren't worried at all about your and my interests. The only thing they're fighting over is how much of the money they're each going to take out of our wallets.
We heard from Judith in Madison, who brought up net neutrality. Now, that the end of net neutrality kicked in this week. Is that going to have an interplay here? Is that going to give this AT&T Time Warner, whatever it's going to be called, more wiggle room to do funky stuff with the content they provide and the way they provide it.
Yeah, sure not going to help anything if the FCC is not going to be regulating this conduct either. I have to say, I never was personally a great fan of net neutrality, not because I don't support the principle and I don't fear the power of the folks that control the internet, but just because, you know, that kind of regulation doesn't have a great track record. It's a second best alternative at best to just having competition in the first place. But I'm not actually quite that sure that net neutrality would have been that critical to the future of AT&T with or without Time Warner. AT&T as an internet service provider is certainly a dangerous firm, and it'd be nice if somebody was regulating them. I don't think they were more. They will be more dangerous in that particular respect now that they're integrated.
Briefly, Chris, you mentioned a few other deals in the works that are going to be affected by this. Do you think we're going to see a rash in different industries of this kind of consolidation over the next few years post this ruling?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm tempted to say the sky is falling quite often. in this case, so I'd be tempted to say there's going to be a rush of these. I'm not entirely sure this changes vertical deal-making all that much because vertical deals were already thought to be so difficult to challenge. One thing you can say with a lot of confidence is executives like doing deals, and their bankers like doing deals as well. And they look for the serious consideration, especially once firms get really big, is they look for the deals that they can make that are going to be the least legally problematic. And I think the reason that in the past few years we've been seeing this big spike in vertical deals is because a lot of the firms proposing these have just gotten so big that they can't merge with their horizontal competitors anymore. Horizontal deals are just kind of off the table.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Chris Sagers at Cleveland State University talking about the AT&T Time Warner merger. Now, the 2018 Men's World Cup kicked off today with Russia and Saudi Arabia in the opening match. There are two of the 32 nations fans around the world will cheer on or against in the coming weeks.
Meanwhile, the United States men's soccer team won't be among those since they failed to qualify this time around. But there is good news for U.S. soccer fans this week with the announcement that the country, along with Canada and Mexico, they're going to be hosting the 2026 FIFA World Cup.
Our next guest is here for a look at the latest and to share his love of the game. Laurent Dubois is a professor of romance studies and history at Duke University, where he teaches a class, Soccer Politics. His new book is The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer. Laurent, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be on with you tonight. Thank you.
Well, in your introduction, you say played in Senegal. Soccer is as completely Senegalese as any other form of local culture. It's absolutely German. It's absolutely Argentinian. It's absolutely Haitian. Above all, absolutely Brazilian. Why does soccer, invented in England, you write, why does it translate so well to so many different cultures?
Well, this is part of the mystery at the heart of the game, I think, and a fascinating one at that. And it is what makes the World Cup the spectacle it is, that this is rooted in so many places and it's kind of indigenous to so many places. People have an amazing capacity to make this game their own, to make it feel like part of their culture, the way their players move, the way their players play, but also the stories people tell around the game are all very much local. And at the same time, they're very global in scope and shared across these huge distances.
And part of why you say it travels so well is that all you need is a ball, and you share some stories where, you know, there are kids around the country, they don't even need that to play the game.
Yeah, I mean, there's this, you know, it's a very easy game to play, right? And if you go around the world, you'll see soccer pitches or improvised soccer pitches really all over the place. People make balls out of all kinds of found objects. And again, yeah, I mentioned this moving scene in a film called Timbuktu by Abderrahmane Sissoko, where a group of Islamists take away a ball, but the boys still play. They can basically play the game because they already understand the kind of ballet and the movement of the game fundamentally, even without the ball.
And there's one country that's a holdout. People have said that soccer's been the American game of the future for about 50 years now. Why? It seems like it's growing in popularity. I've been taken into the game by my kids, but it's still not what it is here, not what it is around the world here in the United States. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, the quip comes from Eduardo Galeano, actually, who says in his books, Soccer and Sun and Shadow, you know, soccer is the sport of future and always will be in the United States. I mean, it's a very contradictory and interesting question. It's the sport that is played recreationally the most in this country, right? So there's a vast number of people who play the sport, women and men. Obviously, this is a country where the women's game is extremely strong. We've won 3 World Cups, and women's soccer is really on the rise here. So it's all over the place, and yet it doesn't have the space, the place in the sports media landscape or in the collegiate sports landscape that, of course, the big sports like basketball and football do. It is actually among people under the age of 35 now has surpassed baseball as the third most popular sport, according to local recent polls. But there is also this kind of persistent sense that it's somehow not quite American, right? That it's sort of an odd sport, not quite our sport, our national sport. And I think that's very interesting. And that comes up, of course, during the period of the World Cup.
And you talk about all the things to love about the game, the beauty, the international appeal. But in some cases, we like the game in spite of some things. FIFA, the organization itself, and corruption, the bleed through of politics, the game being hosted in places like Russia or Qatar with very thin connections to democratic participation. We love the game. People love the game despite the warts.
Well, absolutely. I mean, something that is this powerful, right? Soccer is so powerful. I think is undoubtedly always going to attract the powerful. It's going to attract money. It's going to attract those in political power who want to use it and twist it to their own ends. And that has been a feature of World Cups since the 1930s, when Mussolini hosted a World Cup that was destined, you know, that was meant to really sort of support his regime and support Italian fascism. So there's a long history of that. And then at the same time, of course, the sport pushes back in the other direction. The teams are, of course, made up usually very often of people who come from the margins of the societies where they grew up. So they're these kind of representatives of the country, but that look very different often in their backgrounds and in the way they are than, say, the political leaders in their country. So you do have that as well. And then the game also just invites people to make allegiances across national boundaries. Most people are like citizens of the United States this year. They can't root for their own team in the World Cup. There's only 32 countries represented. So in a sense, we're like a lot of the rest of the world, and that means you have to choose a team. And that's an interesting process as well.
Talking to Laurent Dubois, author of The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer. Well, let's look at this World Cup field. Can you give advice on people picking a team? I think reading your book, I know your pick. It's France. Do I have that right?
Yes, I'm a longtime fan of the French team and also a fan of the Belgian team. I'm actually was born in Belgium and I grew up in the U.S., but my family's from Belgium. So those are two favorites of mine, along with Senegal, which I think is a really exciting African team.
Well, my daughters have filled out their brackets. One's got Germany going all the way. One's got Belgium. For someone who wants to watch the game and pick a side and hope for them win or lose, how can we Americans evaluate who's out there and get on a side?
Well, there's so many different reasons to pick a team, right? I mean, Germany is obviously always a favorite. They're an incredible team. They've got a great history. So is Brazil. Italy, which is the other powerhouse team people often root for, is not there this year. So it just gives you a sense of how up and down soccer can be. But I think others would like to pick a team where they like some of the personalities of the player or maybe underdogs to root for. I think a lot of people are really excited this year about Egypt because of their sort of lead striker, Mohamed Salah, who's become a kind of phenomenon around the world. A team like France or a team like Belgium is also interesting because you have players of really diverse backgrounds, a lot of players of immigrant backgrounds. Then there's teams like Iceland, you know, that are the real surprises at the tournament, at least a really small country that has this kind of powerful team. And that's always fun to root for. As you saw, I sort of have 3 teams. I think choosing a couple is a good idea. But also, I think people should watch and decide who they love, how they like the team. That's what they're watching. They like the way they play. Many people in the U.S. will also be following professional soccer, and they may have a favorite player that they follow on their team, and they can follow that into the tournament as well.
In the heart of your book, you go position by position in different chapters and talk about the role of different players. Let's talk about the keeper. That's that standout role where you get to hang out and do nothing for a lot of the game in some ways, and then you get the credit or the blame in that one key moment.
Absolutely. Yeah, I start with the goalkeeper. And really, the book is meant to kind of introduce people to the language, to the architecture of the game, the rules, and how to watch it to sort of in a way to get maximum pleasure out of it, because I do think it's a sport that can bring people a lot of pleasure to watch and to play, of course. The goalkeeper is this very kind of outlier figure, obviously the one player who can use their hands in a sport that otherwise you cannot, a player who's sort of contained largely in the penalty box, which is a very large area. It's actually about as big as a basketball court, but still smaller than the field where the other players run around. And also, of course, has this very visible role and, you know, sort of the last person before the ball goes into the net. And so there's a kind of tragic nature, I think, to being a goalie, you know, knowing that no matter what you do, maybe, you know, sometimes a ball will get passed. And I write about figures like Vladimir Nabokov and Albert Camus and other intellectuals who, as they were growing up, were playing as goalkeepers and kind of muse about whether that affected their larger life and the perspective.
It's this existential position in sports.
There is, right? There's a kind of an acceptance, you know, and I start that actually chapter with a letter that Gianluigi Buffon, who's this Italian goalkeeper, one of the greatest, you know, we've seen, who wrote a kind of love letter to his goal, which is full of kind of humor and pathos as well. It's a very interesting position, and I think, you know, at the root of the team and fundamental to it, but always a bit of an outsider as well.
We're talking to Laurent Dubois, author of The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer.
800-642-1234 is the number to call to join our conversation about soccer. Do you have questions about the game? Fans, who are you rooting for in this 2018 FIFA World Cup? Are you excited that the 2026 Cup is going to come to North America? What do you love about the sport? You can call in now with your thoughts, your comments, and your questions at 800-642-1234. You can also share your thoughts by tweeting at Central Time WPR.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Chris Molina. We're continuing our exploration of soccer's role in global culture as the 2018 World Cup kicks off today in Russia. Laurent Dubois stays with us as our guide. He's the author of the book, The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer. He also teaches a soccer politics class at Duke University.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Will you be watching the World Cup? Is there a team you're pulling for? What got you into the game? Is it something you've been into since being a kid, or maybe your kids, as mine did, brought you into it? Or do you have questions? You're maybe a casual fan, want to know a little more? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. To our callers we go. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I guess what I like about soccer is there's so many different styles that different countries play, and it's like any sport. The more you know about it, the more interesting it becomes, and the strategies and all that sort of stuff. My father was a goalie in a semi-professional team in the Netherlands, so I always root for the Netherlands. Unfortunately, they didn't make it into the tournament, so I'm rooting for Iceland because they're a long shot, and they're such a small country, like the Netherlands, mm-hmm. they're a small country. So the other thing about soccer I think that's interesting is that it doesn't demand a certain body type. I mean, you have mm-hmm. to be a good athlete, but you don't have to be tall or, you know, like football or basketball. Anyone can play, and it's a great game. I love watching it. I'm excited that it's time for the World Cup. I'm disappointed that the Netherlands didn't make it into the tournament, but it's a truly a world, you know, a world event, not just a, you know, one particular country.
Willem, thanks a lot. A lot there, Laurent. You write about the body type, and there, you know, some huge stars. People looked at them when they were young and thought, this is not an athlete.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely a vital point, and really one of the kind of democratic aspects of the game, right? There are a lot of players who, when they were growing up, they were told, you know, they could never make it. Maradona was told he was too short to succeed as a professional. Lionel Messi is also quite short. And of course, it's also been a sport that have been played by women through its whole history, and that's one of the things I really emphasize in the book as well, is that this has crossed gender lines and has been a really important sport for women throughout, although their participation has been constrained at different times by the federations. But I also think that's true. There's a kind of invitation that comes from that, because when you watch athletes, you know, who look a little bit more like you, or you can imagine being in their shoes, that does make a kind of connection between the fan and the athlete, and the connection between playing and watching is important.
Willem, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Laurent, let's talk a little more about the women's game. As you say and as you write, it's been around forever. It has really not always gotten a lot of love from the official organization, FIFA, right?
Well, far from it. I mean, in fact, what I write about in the book is that it was really popular in early 20th century England, and then the English Football Federation actually banned the women's game, essentially told women they couldn't play in the stadia and on the pitches that they oversaw. Obviously, they couldn't stop women from playing entirely, but they excluded them from the official game, and that set back the sport significantly. And there were similar bans in other places. So that's, I think, a really key thing for people to understand, is that it was held back. And now, obviously, we're in a different phase where it's growing again, but the inequalities still persist as a result of having been held back earlier in the 20th century.
One of the most confusing things for a lot of people, I'll include myself in this, in trying to understand the game, is the offsides rule. Mm-hmm. I think I know that I could explain it in words, but now I think I can spot it accurately 75% of the time when I'm watching mm-hmm. a game. And that rule has changed over the years.
It has evolved over the years, and I one of the goals I set in writing this book was trying to, hopefully I do, explain the offside rule so that people will fully understand it, because it is really the core architecture of the game.
Yeah.
I mean, it shapes everything about the game, and if you don't get it, it's hard to sort of watch games and understand what's going on. It's also a very, very important and useful rule that I think is fundamental to the kind of flow and the motion of the game. If you didn't have it, I think you would have a game that was far less interesting, but it did evolve over time. The numbers of players and so forth. So I kind of detail that. And I find, I'm a historian, I think that when you understand the history of something, it often kind of elucidates a lot better, you know, why it is what it is. And so that's one of the contributions I tried to make in that chapter on the defender.
Let's take another call now. Maria is with us in Holman. Maria, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I just flipped on the radio and was listening about soccer and very intrigued. And I'm home for the summer. I'm working overseas in Doha, Qatar, and we're going to be hosting the 2022 games. So it's just been really fun for me to come from the States and go to all these soccer tournaments and watch the games happen and all the excitement and the rivalries and the allies and just see the country, like, getting set up for it, mm-hmm. like building everything and the infrastructure. So it's a very fun sport to go watch. I've never watched soccer when I lived here in the United States. So it's a very fun game to watch.
Maria, thank you so much for sharing that. And Laurent, you write in the book about seeing a lot of games live. Can you share, just in our last minute and a half or so, some of your best moments seeing soccer in person?
Well, some of them have come. I did go to the 2010 World Cup in South Africa. I was at the final then and saw also a very painful game, Ghana-Uruguay, where Ghana lost, which I was rooting for. But those were pretty extraordinary moments. There is a way in which being there, you know, you really feel kind of at the center of the world in a way, and being part of those crowds. But I've also been attending Carolina Courage, which is the National Women's Soccer League team here in Cary, nearby in Durham. And those are wonderful games, you know, smaller crowds, but just the dynamism of the crowd and the players and the connection there is something pretty miraculous. And when the game begins, I just think, you know, I don't know what's going to happen, and I love to sort of be surprised. And you always are surprised and taken by what transpires on the pitch.
And we've got this World Cup starting today in Russia, again 8 years from now in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. Are you kind of trying to clear your calendar for 8 years hence to make sure you have room to catch some of the games while they're on this continent?
Well, I actually always clear my calendar for the World Cup, or both the Men's and Women's World Cup, which makes for some luckily I'm not teaching in the summer, but it's true that that's going to be really interesting. And it means that the next 8 years are also a time of really thinking about soccer in this country and the connections with Canadian and Mexican soccer. So I think it's a big opportunity. It also poses a lot of challenges and questions, and there'll be a lot of debates as well about how the tournaments run and those sorts of questions. But it's going to be a massive tournament, both geographically. It's going to be the largest geographical spread of a tournament ever, and also in size, because they're increasing the number to 48 teams. So this is going to be kind of a huge thing after the Russia and Qatar car tournaments, and there's going to be a lot to do to get ready for it.
Laurent, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Laurent Dubois is a professor of romance studies and history at Duke University. He's the author of the new book, The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer. The 2018 FIFA World Cup continues for about the next month.